I'd like to welcome you all to Research Plus Pizza, a lunchtime lecture series brought to you by the University of Texas Libraries and featuring research presentations by faculty from across the university. I hope you've had the chance to help yourself to the drinks and pizza, which are here courtesy, the pizza's here courtesy of our generous program supporter, Austin's Pizza, which has been underwriting this program for 2 years now. We'd also like to know what you think about the program content and what we could do for you in terms of future content. If you're sitting in the center chairs section, you probably are sitting near one of these half-sheet feedback forms. If you're over at the tables, there may be one on your table, or if it's not, it's on these little wooden sections here at the end of the center aisle. We'd very much like to know what you think of today's program, and also we'd like to know if there's research that you know of going on here at the university that you'd like to see presented in one of the future Research Plus Pizza programs, because we are looking for content for the spring. So do let us know that. Because today's program is going to be recorded, we'd appreciate it if you'd raise your hand to ask a question so that I could come to you with this microphone so that we can get it on the podcast. And also, our presenter is going to speak on his subject for a while, and then the questions will come after his comments. So if you'll hold your questions till after his comments and then raise your hand, I'll bring you the microphone. It takes a lot of people to make this program happen every month, and I'd just like to recognize them here and thank them all, and especially our presenter, Dr. Robert Young. He works in the fields of urban planning, sustainable economic development, and urban ecology. His research centers on the planning, governance, and financing of metropolitan green infrastructure and on economic development initiatives for sustainable cities and regions. He recently co-founded the University of Oregon's Sustainable Cities Initiative, described by the New York Times and Fortune magazine, respectively, as perhaps the most comprehensive effort by a U.S. university to infuse sustainability into its curricula and community outreach, and addressing and catalyzing change across all issues that impinge upon sustainability. Dr. Young served as an advisor to Governors Ted Kulongoski and John Kitzhaber of Oregon on issues of sustainable economic development. He also founded American Soil Incorporated, a successful large-scale New Jersey composting company, described in the Wall Street Journal as the future of organic resources management. Dr. Young's most recent academic publications include articles in the Journal of the American Planning Association, Urban Forestry and Urban Greening, Journal of Environmental Planning and Management, Urban Ecosystems, as well as a chapter in the book Garden Cities to Green Cities, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. He teaches the courses Green Cities and Sustainable History and Practice. Please welcome Dr. Robert Young.
All right. Thank you for coming. I have two talks to give this week. You're the first. And this one I'm not afraid of. And then on Friday, I have to give a presentation on Canada to my son's kindergarten class. And that one I'm really, really afraid of. Because I kind of know a little bit of where you guys are coming from. And after many years of public education, you've been taught to sit quietly and listen, or at least pretend to listen, whereas the kindergartners have not had enough electrical shocks yet to teach them to sit quietly in a chair. So for you, maybe I'm interesting and maybe I'm not. For the kindergartners, it's like, be interesting or die. So there you go. So thanks for coming. I am relatively new to the University of Texas. I came here last year as a professor. Prior to that, I was at the University of Oregon. My professional aspiration is to be the first ambassador from the Republic of Texas to the Republic of Cascadia, should they ever break free from the United States. So I want to do a couple things here. I want to briefly tell you a little bit about my research and what motivates that, in case any of you have a burning desire to know about that. And then I want to talk about what we did in Oregon with Sustainable Cities Initiative. Because I think it literally, there is no other university in the world that has done what we did there to date, although there are many that are seizing on the example, one of which is University of Texas at Austin, which is launching something called Texas City Lab, which was inspired by SCI, so I want to talk to you a little bit about TCL. And then I just want to finish with a few comments about the future of Austin and the future of Texas and how it all ties together. We're going to do that in about 12 minutes. How's the sound? Is this good? I feel like I'm ready to go into space. T minus 10, 9, 8. So what I work on, there's a thing. I'm in the city planning department, city community and regional planning department in the School of Architecture. And if you pick up pretty much almost any publication in that world, you will see in the opening one or two paragraphs some sort of rap about how, for the first time in human history, more than half of us live in cities. And, you know, it's sort of, at this point, I've read that so many times, I don't even think about it that much. But when you, that's good. If you do reflect on it, it's a profound transformation. Even when my father, who is still alive and hail fellow well met, was a kid, it was relatively rare for humans to live in cities. Thus, they had expressions like urbane. You know, David Niven, the actor, he was urbane with a little mustache. You know, how are you, darling? I live in a city. Would you like to see one sometime? You know, that sort of thing. And then there was the other side of city, which was a city slicker. You know, someone who was going to get advantage of you, someone who was real sharp. You know, because they were a unique human example. And now, that's where we all live. And the big secret, of course, is this is where all Texas lives, you know, in cities now. It's not out on the range all by yourself. So the fact is that the crucible within which the future of our civilization, of our species, will be decided is no longer in the countryside. It's in cities. It's in what we do in cities. This is the arena and this is the stage. This doesn't mean that what happens in the hinterland isn't important, but frequently what happens in the hinterland is only important because of how it affects the cities and the relationship between the cities and the countryside. So the cities are a major, major place of whatever revolutions will occur in our society. So my research focuses on that. I have a background, as you noted, in the private sector and in the public sector, and now I'm in academia. And in academia, coming out of the public and private sector, my main interests are how do we make this transition? We already know a lot about solar panels. We already know a lot about how to keep water clean. We already know a bunch of this stuff. Not that there isn't more to learn, but we have a tremendous body of knowledge on that. What we don't have so much knowledge on is how to make that transition. One of the things I present in my classes is readings on solar energy that date from the 1870s and the 1890s. Did you know that ancient Rome, the Roman Empire, had solar access legislation? You couldn't block the solar gain to another building. So thousands of years, some of these ideas have been around. Now we're in this crux where we have to make this transition. So my research is a lot about how do we get the governance, how do we get the information flows, how do we get the politics right to make these things happen. I'll give you one example, since we don't have all day, which is I did a study of 9 cities in the United States that have decided to plant a million or more trees in their cities to increase the canopy cover and reduce urban heat island effect. I went around and I interviewed everyone in these cities that pertained to these programs. And I wrote it up, and it got published in the Journal of the American Planning Association, which is sort of the journal of record in my field, which is great. A short while after that, I got a call from one of the mayor of Los Angeles' chiefs of staff, asking me to come to L.A. And I came to L.A., and it was the night before they were going to shut down the Occupy encampment in L.A. And I saw some news people there, and I said, when are the police going to come? They said, well, the eviction order is at sundown. And I said, so they're going to come at 4 in the morning, right? He says, yep, 4 in the morning. So I went back to my hotel room, went to sleep, set my alarm for 3:45. Alarm went off at 3:45. I got up, I threw back the curtains, looked out the window, and sure enough, boom, in comes the cops to clear out Occupy at 4 a.m. Anyways, that next morning I went down and met with the mayor. He was tired because he'd been up all night with the Occupy issue. He was backing away from their million trees thing. And they asked me to present my research, which I did. And he's sort of listening. He's firing a lot of questions at me. And then he suddenly turns to someone. He says, you know, where's Dale such and so? Well, get her in here. She was in charge of public relations. And he said, get her in here. This is fairly interesting. And I thought, you know, come from the mayor of L.A., I will take fairly interesting, and I will run with it. So the idea, this is, to me, is what I'm trying to do. When I was in Oregon, I wrote a paper about Oregon's economy, and which I won't get into the details of, and it's in second review right now in a journal. And the governor of Oregon, John Kitzhaber, got wind of this research, asked me to meet him. This is why you got to have your elevator speech down. This is why you got to do your readings, right? And said, tell me about Oregon's economy. And so for 12 minutes, I was like, well, blah, 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 blah. And then he cuts me off. He says, you know, I've lived here for years and years. I could never do what you just did. I want you to write my economic development platform. So I took that research, and that research is now the existing economic development policy of the state of Oregon. So these are my little holy grails, is to do this research, do it rigorously, academically, search for truth, justice, and the global, interdisciplinary, multicultural way, which has replaced the American way recently, and then translate that into actual on-the-ground policy and impacts with states, with cities, with regions. So that's what I do. It's mostly around green infrastructure, sustainable regional economic development, and just the whole notion of green cities in general. So come take my class. When I was in Oregon, I was there for 4.5 years as a professor. We would sit around, and now the average journal article is read by 7 people. Okay. Now occasionally you get a journal article that goes viral and 3,000 people read it, but most of them read about 7 people. And if you subtract the author's partner and their mother, it's read by 5 people. So it doesn't get out there. There's great research. It doesn't get out there. So we're in Oregon. We're sitting around one day as professors. We're sort of shooting the breeze. And we said, this is ridiculous. This is great stuff. We've got to get out there. And so we created the Sustainable Cities Initiative. And it was my only experience of what it's like to be in the Beatles, because we wrote all these applications for grants. They all got denied. And then one day we just said, screw it. Let's just do this thing. So we got in touch with an alumnus who was a city manager of the 4th largest city in Oregon. Now, that's the 4th largest city in Oregon, so that means about 12 people live there. And it's actually a relatively decent-sized town. And we launched the Sustainable Cities Initiative. We went to the city and we said, what issues do you need looked into to become a more sustainable city? It was a wide range. We need to design new types of streetlights. We need to work on this new development of 17,000 households to make it more economically feasible. All this stuff, any range you want on that. And then I went around, and I went to the law department, the business school, the planning department, political science, the art department, and found professors with classes that were just doing sort of an abstract class. Write me a paper at the end of the term. You'll write it, I'll read it, maybe, and your mom will read it, maybe, and that's it. Instead of that saying, I want you to do, with these people, I want you to do research on this issue for the city and meet with the city officials and produce something that's of high quality. We got 30 classes engaged in this. And it was a great thing because it was a year long. So I would do a planning class, then I would pass it off to a law school class who would then do the legal structure around the plans that I had developed. Then they would pass it off to a business school class that would do the financial bonding and arrangements to make it set. So at the end of the year, I could hand to the city, here's the plan, here's the regulatory legal framework, and here's the financial structures you need to make this occur. Then what we would do is we would pick the best student out of every class and say, okay, we're going to pay you to edit the final work. So that we didn't just hand in a bunch of papers with different fonts and unedited and non-spell-checked stuff to these people. We handed them professional quality stuff that the students got paid to put into that level. We did this for the first city, and it just exploded. And so we went from a zero-budget organization to a million-dollar organization in 3 years. And that $1 million came not from the largesse of the university. It came from communities in Oregon, which is not a rich state, that were so desperate for planning capacity that they were more than willing to cobble together some federal grants, some money of their own, some state grants, and provide $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 for us to go out and do this work. Private sector got upset. They said, you're taking our jobs away. We said, no, we're not taking your jobs away because we are, after all, just students, the people working here. They're not going to produce a finished architectural schemata of the new city hall. What they are going to do is bump up the quality of the eventual RFP so that when that request for proposal comes to your architecture firm, it's going to be at a much higher level of quality, and you might actually get to do the kind of work you actually want to do because we'll have raised the bar, we'll have brought up the game. So that was what we triggered off with SCI, and it has just rolled. We've had conferences. I mean, I'm no longer at University of Oregon. Faculty have come from all over the country to learn about the SCI model and see if it can be applied where they are. Texas City Lab, which is just kicking off now out of the Community Regional Planning Program, but keep in mind, SCI came out of the planning and architecture school, but it included departments all over the university. Texas City Lab is the same way. It's being born out of the School of Architecture, but it's going to include departments all around the university. So if you're in arts and sciences or mechanical engineering or computer sciences, you can tie into this. And it gives you real portfolio stuff when you go for the job. my crew did a report that won the American Planning Association Special Achievement Award for what we accomplished by using deep ecology for a large-scale development that was going to be happening in Springfield, Oregon. So it can bring you accolades, it can give you portfolio stuff, but it does real work for real communities. So Texas City Lab is right now negotiating with a city in Texas to be the first test city to do this. And there's a rap that, you know, Texans don't like planning. You know, Americans don't like planning. It's very, very unmanly. You know, when I go to planning school, I always put on a bra, you know, because it's very unmanly, and I'm going to go to planning school, so I better put on my female accoutrement, right, because it's effeminate or something, which is, of course, ridiculous. There's traffic signals all over Texas. That's a form of planning. There are sidewalks in many communities. There's zoning. There's you can't put a tannery next to an elementary school. There's planning all over this state. And there's growth all over the state of Texas. Texas is booming, as you all know. Austin, I believe, is the fastest growing city in the United States right now. And close behind it are Houston and San Antonio and other parts of the state. Texas is also rapidly becoming the most urbanized state in the nation. As a result, there's a tremendous need for a long-term look at where Texas is going to be. And I want to just close with a couple comments and we go to Q&A. I was at a conference, a national planning conference, and I got to chatting with, you know, you just start talking to somebody, you don't know who they are, and just chatting with them. And he says, so, you're Robert Young. You used to be at the University of Oregon, didn't you? And I said, yeah. He says, you got a Texas thing on now. I said, I'm at the University of Texas at Austin. He said, what do you think of that? And I said, oh, it's a great university. I mean, going from the U of O to UT is like stepping off a fishing boat onto a battleship. This is an amazing place. It's like, we want to end world hunger. Ba-boom, and then it's over, right? Now we want to go to Mars. Ba-boom, and then we're in Mars, right? We want to take millions of people and settle them in a state which has almost no water and topsoil. Boom, there it is. It's the Texas way, right? So it's a great place to be in that regard. But I said it's got a world of hurt coming down the road in terms of water, in terms of agriculture, in terms of depleted assets, in terms of traffic problems, sprawl. They don't have urban growth boundaries like Oregon. They don't have adequate bicycle infrastructure like Oregon. They don't have agricultural protection clauses as strong as Oregon. And they're going to be, and I said, in short, if Texas doesn't watch out, Texas is going to be the Detroit of the future. And he said, that's an interesting phrase. And he said, I'm the editor-in-chief of Cornell University Press. Would you write a book with that title? And I said, well, I just moved to Texas. I don't know if I want to make that many enemies that quickly. You know? So I turned down the offer. But the point is this, that Texas, a lot of my friends gave, oh, you're moving to Texas. You know, Texas is the spear point of where this country is headed, absolutely, no doubt. You know, the Battle of Waterloo may have been won on the playing fields of Eaton, as General Wellington said, but the Battle of the United States will be won on the playing fields of Texas. Whichever way this state goes in terms of how it handles its natural resources, its human resources, and its political disposition will determine and color this country for the next half century. In the same way that Massachusetts at its time did, New York in its time did, Virginia in its time did, now it's Texas's moment. If it continues on with the type of growth that it has at this point, with an unthinking level of growth, or where the amount of planning is pointed to in Austin, which is a mess, right, then Texas has no long-term future. If Texas, on the other hand, does what Texas does best, which is get serious about issues, grab them by the horns, and change the national consensus around them, then Texas will be the leader of a new United States with a particularly good form of barbecue to go along with it. So that's where Texas City Lab, I think, is a very interesting point coming out now at this time in Texas's history. And that's why I personally am thrilled to be a professor at the University of Texas. Thank you very much. I prepared very deeply for this talk.
Dr. Young will take your questions now, so if you'll just raise your hand, I'll bring the microphone to you.
Yes, sir.
Hi. I went to UT back in the late 60s, early 70s, but I'm just working back here now, came to visit, and I, last night, missed my turn off MOPAC, and it took me an hour to get home. you know, just a traffic nightmare.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering how that fits into sustainable Austin.
Right. I think the city now has the third worst traffic in the United States. That's what I'm hearing. It's extremely bad. I live in Hyde Park, so I walk to work, and I intentionally bought there. It was more expensive a house, but my transportation is no longer a factor. You know, you just come and go. One of the things that that a lot of economic development people make a mistake around is they think of economic development around consumption and around production, and that's economic development. And transportation is an ancillary thing that happens externally to it. Clearly, it's an absolute part of the efficiency of your production. This is the genius of what's going on with the growth boundaries in Oregon, and even the state planning that's happening in a place like New Jersey, which is not known for its, you know, bucolic green cities. And when they've run the numbers on it, they've found that the savings in terms of tax base and lost work time goes into the billions of dollars. And this is something that I think needs to happen, needs to be a cultural change, especially in a place like Texas, but elsewhere in the United States, which is the, we don't get into those kinds of regulations because we believe in efficiency and production and economic development and growth, and that's where the money comes from. What I say is that you grow in the pattern we're growing now, you become an army camped far from its base of supply. You become very vulnerable. Ask Napoleon during his invasion of Moscow if the long supply line was a good idea, right? So what places like Austin and places around the United States, not just Texas, are doing is that they're giving very little thought to where their production and their affordability of housing goes and the planning around the housing and how the, what the footprint is. And as a result, they're building in a tremendous overhead cost that the only way it stays hidden is if you constantly have the throughput of new dollars. But the minute that goes away, the water goes down, then all the inequities appear. So you take a city like Denver that was the it city in the 70s, or a city like Atlanta that was the it city in the 80s, and they just went willy-nilly with the growth. But the minute the growth machine shifted to a new city, then all of the social dysfunctionality and the costs associated with that type of design came home to roost on those cities. Detroit's a great example, built around the automobile, and now they're the first major city in the U.S. to be going into bankruptcy. So if, from my perspective, you're talking about real growth, real development, real wealth retention, then issues like that become vital because, you know, Austin, Texas, Texas may produce oil, but Austin, Texas doesn't produce much oil. So every dollar spent on extra gas, every dollar spent on auto parts is just leaving the local economy. So that's where myself and my colleagues really attack that question, is transportation as an efficiency and then also one that creates inequity. Because there's a phrase, drive to qualify. You can't afford to live in downtown Austin, just keep driving out of town until you qualify for a mortgage or a rental. And then you live out there and try to get back and forth. So the thing to fight with that, in short, is this notion that any control of that will somehow impair economic growth. It's actually putting those regulations on. I meant to turn that off before I came here. I'm sorry. Go away. It's getting control on that so that we actually have long-term wealth development in the city. Yes, sir.
What would be an example of a regulation that, you know, to address that?
To create that.
To address,
Well, I mean, just take, you don't have to, it doesn't have to be some avant-garde Oregon thing, you know. It can be something as simple as Hyde Park, Texas. Hyde Park neighborhood right here in Austin, which was planned in the 1880s along Speedway with the trolley line. Wonderful amenities, urban forest, parkland, swimming pool, and just quick shot to downtown by mass transit. As a result, the property values are much higher there than they are in adjoining neighborhoods right in that area because of the intentional planning. But well, what you can, I mean, there are many things, right? But one example is what we did in New Jersey. I was on the New Jersey State Planning Commission. I was a representative of the Department of Commerce on the State Planning Commission. And what we did was we looked at the transit infrastructure of the state. And New Jersey's all about transportation, right? It, as Ben Franklin said, it's a barrel with holes in both ends, Philadelphia and New York, and everything's just draining into those cities. And we said, okay, here's the transportation infrastructure. Now let's identify areas where we want to concentrate growth that will have access to high-quality transit and with options other than the automobile. And then if you want to go outside of this, Governor Glenn Denning did this in Maryland as well. You say, look, you want to build out way out beyond West Hills? God bless you and good luck. But if you want any subsidies from the municipality or the state to put in your sewer and to put in your sidewalks, put in your curbs, you're on your own. Because we don't want to incur the tax base expense, because suburbs don't pay for themselves in taxes of that. You want to go do it? Go do it. It's the free market. You are free to go engage in that market. But don't come around and ask us for a subsidy that then becomes a perpetual public sector subsidy to support your subdevelopment, which you grab the money from and go. But if you want that public-private support, then you come into these areas. Well, then the counter-argument is like, oh, Christ, you know, but think of the density, and you know, like you're building, you know, Queens, New York, right next to beautiful Austin. We don't want that kind of density. It's ugly, it's terrible, blah, blah, blah. It can be, like anything. You can do it stupid or you can do it well. There's a professor at the University of Oregon, I encourage you to look at his work, Brooke Muller, wonderful guy. And his objective is, how do we increase human density in neighborhoods and biodiversity density? How do we make them greener than they were before and have more people than they were before? And he works with ecologists and does wonderful stuff. He works a lot with Metro Portland. Does, I mean, I like, you know, have a little altar to Brooke and I make little worshiping motions in front of it because he does such good work. So we can actually make the cities more biodiverse, more dense, and better functioning from a social and ecological perspective. And it's very doable. So that would be an example of that. You figure out where you want it to go based on transportation options, and then you only do public-private in those areas, but then you put ramifications around it so that it retains beauty and ecological functionality. Yes?
So a number of researchers at UT have said that Austin might be the most racially segregated city in the United States.
Yes.
And as we're experiencing more urbanization and more growth, we're starting to see a lot of those disparities in access to resources. So how do you think that the Texas City Lab could address this issue of social equity?
Yeah. Okay, that's a really important point. Because you can't have an ecological city that's a socially unjust city. And the reason for that is that what happens is, one of the reasons is, and it's happening in East Austin right now, where the value of the land goes up, so the taxes go up. So even if you own your house in East Austin and have lived there for 20 years, your taxes drive you out because you can't cover the taxes because you're on a fixed income or a low income or median income. So even if you've bought it and paid it off to the bank, you still don't have control over that, and you can be pushed out. Where do you get pushed out? You get pushed out to Pflugerville, you get pushed out to the outlying areas, and then if you are still involved in the working community or just want to come downtown, now there's an additional energy cost to you coming downtown. So it becomes a green, we talk about this with eco-districts, which is the new thing in Portland. It's a new form of, white people went out to the suburbs and let everybody pour in the city. And now we kind of want to go back to urban life. So we're going to go back in and we're going to push all the minorities and low-income people back out to the periphery. So you have to secure the land base in order to do that. So some people are talking about dropping I-35 below grade and letting the great land rush into East Austin begin. And my question is always like, okay, that's fine, but what are you going to do to secure equity there? Well, there's grassroots things you can do, like community land trusts, where you can get land out of the speculative market. But this is a place where the government has to have a role. They didn't used to have economics departments and political science departments back in the old days. They had one department. It was called political economy. There is no economics without politics. There is no politics without economics. It is political economy. You can never address an economic question without simultaneously addressing the political question, and vice versa for economics. So when you go in and do that type of upgrades in a neighborhood, you also have to put controls over the type of development that can happen there to secure people their place there. You also have to invest in affordability. It's getting to the point in Austin now where people are spending as much on housing as they are on transportation because it's turning into a pure perfect storm. So yes, Austin becomes a hip, wonderful, lovely city. And you don't even have to do it racially, not necessarily for whites, but for people who can afford it regardless of their race and color. So diversity becomes a bunch of well-off people having a good time instead of a diversity of class and ethnic mixes. So this is the leg on the stool that is always lost in sustainability. People say, what is sustainability? Sustainability is equity economics and ecology. It's the three E's. But if you look at almost all of the sustainability literature, they will talk to you about return on investment and economic efficiency. They'll talk about ecological efficiency. And at the very end, there'll be a thing about equity. When I worked as the head of the Office of Sustainability for the governor of tech for New Jersey, 18th largest economy in the world, right? Big place economically. And I worked for Christine Todd Whitman, first female governor of New Jersey and a Republican. And we put together our report on sustainability. I was the director of the Office of Sustainability. And I put that definition in, environment, economics, and equity. And she read it, and her chief of staff said, take the line equity out. And I said, I can't. It's the UN definition of sustainability. It's the United Nations. Do you want the black helicopters to come here? And she said, what is this? The Communist Manifesto? Take it out. So that's the kind of reaction against the equity issue. And it's one that requires a lot of organizing. I'll use one example that's being lost right now in Austin. A tremendous opportunity is being lost in Austin. There's a big brouhaha going on right now about urban farms over in East Austin. And there are folks in East Austin, well-motivated, I'm sure, frequently not listened to, I'm also sure, who are saying, this is another white land grab. This is about gentrification, da-da-da-da. Trust me. All the urban farms over the next 50 years could happen in Austin, and they're not going to be what's behind the real loss of equity in the low-income communities in our neighborhood. It's about a certain type of development going into that. It has very little to do with urban farming, but they're grabbing at that straw. Instead of building the difficult coalition between the environmental faction in Oregon and the people of color and low-income faction in Austin, you put those two together, you have a dynamite coalition that can accomplish a lot. But when the low-income folks and the ethnic folks and the farmers are all fighting each other, then the developers are laughing on the side. You go about that. That was really dangerous, but it didn't happen. So now we can go ahead and do what we're doing. How do you think we got growth boundaries in Oregon? We got growth boundaries in Oregon because people started coming up from California and building their little mansions out in the countryside. And the timber industry said, Jesus, you know, if they do this, it's going to drive up our taxes. And we need low taxes to make lumber work. And the environmentalists said, we want wilderness. And so the industry got together with environmentalists and said, let's make a coalition and get land use, best land use in the country passed. That opportunity is being missed in Austin right now because the farmers are too caught up in their own heads and low-income people are too caught up in being beaten up and looking for somebody to strike back at instead of building that coalition and going after the real issue, which is development that doesn't take equity into account.
So if you were going to change three things in Austin, given the list that you just gave us to make Austin more sustainable, what would you change and why?
I would change my looks. three things I would change in Austin, I would have serious land use. And when I say serious land use, everybody, anti-business, I would say to them, there's one person in this room that's pro-business, and I think it's me, because you let it go the way it's going. You got a, the Kiplinger letter came out and said, Austin, it's the best business market for the next 10 years, because they know, Kiplinger's not stupid, they know at 10 years at this pace, and it's going to be a nightmare, and then capital will go elsewhere. So I would say good, solid land use that will allow this city to maintain its integrity and harvest that wealth for a long time to come. Second thing would be a serious commitment to alternative transportation in this town. I just got a brand new dual-frame bicycle to ride my daughter to school. I rode my daughter to school every day in Eugene. And it's still in a box in my living room because I'm afraid to put it together because I can just imagine getting aced on the way to school. And if it was just me, it would be like, long-winded professor dies in bicycling accident. Big deal. But my daughter's going to be on the back end of that bicycle, and that's a hell of a responsibility. So serious transportation for pedestrians and bicyclists to be able to get around the city. You know, don't snow here, so really you can do stuff with bicycles. So that'd be the second thing. And then the third thing would be, and I said land use, but I meant more like the sprawl on that one. I would say it's a serious equity land use because this place, is, in many ways, can be You know, it's like Boston. You cross a line, everybody's over here, everybody's over here. And don't tell me how quaint it is on the other side of the line. Oh, you got to go over there for dinner sometime. It's really fun. You know, those people live in this city. They build this city as much as we do, maybe more so. So they're citizens too. Those are three. Land use decisions go on at multiple levels. For instance, there's been public meetings recently around code. They're updating the code, the building codes. Now, building codes can have a lot to do with where you put what and where. There's that component. Land use happens when you redo, like when they did the Imagine Austin plan. That's a comprehensive plan, but it has components of land use in it. It also can happen transportation. Like, there's about 7 master plans in Austin right now. Transportation, solid waste, open space, comprehensive. Many of them, because land is the base upon which you build or move things around, have a land use component in it. So if you go to a Department of Transportation, in most states and cities, they'll say, we don't do land use, we do transportation. Well, transportation is the key to unlock the land use. So I often quote the Antonio Banderas movie of Zorro, when he says, don't go looking for enemies. They'll come into your own life soon enough. You can go to any planning process in the state, and you will find an aspect of land use, a serious aspect of land use, engaged in that.
About sustainability for Austin, I often define Austin in my mind as the metropolitan area or a long, long corridor along I-35. I'm curious if you have suggestions about consolidation politically of municipalities or any approaches to dealing with the political fragmentation.
Yeah. Well, this is the lost holy grail of planning, which is regional planning. The city of New York went after it in the 20s, and as often is the case, I would say chickened out, you know, oh, we can't do that, you know. Well, New York would look very, very different if they had regionally planned it and maintained belts of open space and affordability and that sort of thing. It would be a very different city. It would be a world-class city. Now it's a world-class city because of the type of people that are there, but not the configuration of the city itself. There are very few places that have achieved it. Those that have had some very positive results. The best example I can have in North America would be Toronto. And Toronto decided to do regional planning. And one of the things they did was, and I've driven through it many times, they created a huge agricultural belt around the city to create some kind of coherence between the hinterland and the city itself. But this is extremely difficult to come by. And it's not just Texas. I mean, New Jersey's got very strong local municipality jurisdictions, that sort of thing. So it's extremely hard to come by. It's remarkably rewarding when you can get communities to coordinate like that, but very, very, very difficult. So what has been talked about here is looking not just at Metro Austin, which I agree with you is a way to think about it, but to look at the Texas Triangle, right, which is the 3 major cities of which Austin is a part of, and then to start talking to the federal government about the types of money they're putting into transportation and housing, into solid waste management, those sort of things, and also into open space acquisition. Where's the great national park in Texas? It's in Big Bend. It's pretty far away. And yet, here's all this urban concentration that has nothing within a 6-hour drive of it, right? So looking at that level of coordination, but it would take somebody with, it would take a real, you know, Fearless LaGuardia, Huey Long, Frederick, you know, Franklin Roosevelt, take somebody with a lot more political juice than I have to pull that one off. We can go dig up Barbara Jordan and bring her back.
A couple months ago, I read an article in the paper about South Congress and the food trailers there that were being moved out to make room for a hotel. And I remember the article said something to the effect of, it's kind of ironic because the hotels are serving people who are attracted to South Congress in part because of the food trailers.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought it was a microcosm for Austin being, you know, the battlegrounds between people who live here and development.
Yeah.
So I was curious if you were familiar with how Boston has the B note. I think Santa Fe also has a local currency, and where you feel that could come into sustainable cities.
Yep. I mean, Ithaca Hours, where I got my PhD at Cornell, and Ithaca Hours was launched by Paul Glover, who's a wonderful grassroots activist. He lives in Philadelphia now. Wonderful guy. You can go online. He has a nice piece called The Future History of Los Angeles, which he wrote, which is really fun to read. I think local currencies have a role. They were actually considered by the FDR administration for the Tennessee Valley Authority, that that area of Appalachia would have its own currency to try to keep the capital circulating in that region. I think there's a lot of stuff like that that has merit, and I have personally involved myself in it sometimes. But I would say we've kind of reached the point now, not to denigrate that stuff, because it's important, but we've also reached the time in our social history where we need to grow up, where we need to have City Hall doing the right thing instead of well-intentioned grassroots people off to the side doing a micro good thing. Not that I'm against micro good things, and a lot of things grow and evolve out of that, so I'm not putting it down. But I'm saying we got to do the hard work. Nobody likes to do hard work anymore, right? Everybody likes to be busy and harried and afraid. But the hard work of building the types of coalitions I was talking about reaching across people that we're uncomfortable with, finding mutually beneficial space that we can agree to work on at this time and not have to have everything perfect and their politically correct view and our politically correct view and mesh, to be adults about it and build real coalitions to build really long-term economies to where we live. So it's fine if we do local currency and if we do a community garden or a pilot project to this, a pilot project to that. We've lived in the age of the pilot project. We need to get beyond that now and live in the age of what just happened in New York City. It's going to be a great test case. Got a new mayor, very, very progressive mayor, largest city in the United States. See what he can do there. So we need, I think, to transition, because otherwise places like Austin, you know, Atlanta, that was a sleepy little southern town, great place to move to, is now a nightmare, right? Denver's blown to pieces. We need to get control and build a coalition, a new growth coalition, that actually believes in long-term wealth, actually believes in retaining the quality of the community. And that can't be done by having an opinion or having a blog or going to see a Michael Moore movie. That's stuff that we have to do in the old days, organizing and getting to know people and having real solidarity with what they need to accomplish.
What recommendations or advice would you give to a student wanting to get involved with sustainable initiatives?
Well, with Texas City Lab, find the folks at Texas City Lab and see if you can get your course involved or courses involved. So get your professor connected up with TCL would be a good thing. At the university level, on a broader level, you know, the good thing about sustainability is it's a mile wide and an inch deep, you know. So there's a million organizations out there that are working on stuff. And Austin has a plethora of groups working on that stuff. So what you do is you pick something that you have a personal fire about, whether it's equity and affordability, open space, urban farming, transportation, housing, renewable energy, and just connect up with those guys and just start working with them. One of the things that's interesting about the United States, this comes back to the idea of making money. Let's all go out and make a lot of money, shall we, together. The way we make money in the United States, you don't make money in the United States by opening a pizza parlor. That's how you make a living. But you don't make money doing that. You make a living doing that. The way we make money in the United States is we transition our infrastructure. We go from Indian paths to dirt roads. We go from dirt roads to canals. We go from canals to railroads. We go from railroads to highways. We go from highways to jet planes. We go from jet planes to the internet. We go from wood to coal, coal to oil, oil to renewables. That's how we make money. When an infrastructure turns over, that's when people make big money. If you look at the foundations in the United States, or the banks, the Mellon Bank, right, J.P. Morgan, you look at those, you'll generally find that that family was somehow intimately involved in at least one of those major infrastructure shifts. Now, they generally happen in a sequence. You get a shift in energy, a shift in transportation, then a shift in production. What's happening, interestingly, now with sustainability is you're getting an across-the-board demand for the complete remaking of all of our infrastructures. Transportation, food production, energy production, housing. We have to retool the whole thing to make it work. So you can pick the thing that's your passion and then position yourself on that curve and it will work out for you. Let me give you one example from my own life. Living in New Jersey, have a good liberal arts education, which means I'm first in line at the unemployment office, right? But I'm having great discussions with the other liberal arts guys in the unemployment line. Yeah, what do you think about Descartes? I don't know. I'm going to go buy a book about him as soon as I get my unemployment check. And I looked at the trends, and I said, okay, New Jersey, densest populated state in the union, highest per capita issuance of trash, and 30% of all the trash is crossing state lines for disposal. Very expensive. And those lines are all matching, and I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to start a composting company. So I started a company. I was a graduate student at Cornell University with more gumption than brains. And I went down to this attorney, and I said, I want you to incorporate a company. August 6th, that's what I did it, Hiroshima Day. So I want you to incorporate a company for composting, or call it American Soil Incorporated. He said, where is it? Where does it exist? I said, in my head. He said, all right. And I got a little black binder with the official certificate and a little stamping thing that comes along with it, and I paid him $200, and now I had a company. And then I started going to public hearings in New Jersey. I would go down from Ithaca to public hearings. And I got to this one in Freehold, New Jersey. That's where Bruce Springsteen comes from. It's right on the edge of the urbanization coming down from New York City. And they were talking about building an incinerator. And I stood up at the public hearing and I said, you don't want to build an incinerator. You want to build composting facilities. Because 50% of what goes into an incinerator is burnable, is compostable. And you don't want to burn it. And I said, oh, that's very interesting. Sit down. So I sat down. I went back to the university. Phone rang a couple weeks later. This gruff, Robert Young there. I said, yeah. He says, this is Tom Blanchette. I said, Mr. Blanchette, how are you? He says, I own the largest non-mafia hauling company in the state of New Jersey. I said, how do you do that? I'm a former U.S. Marine. I said, can I stand close to you then if we get involved in business? He said, I want you to come down and see me. So I said, sure, thanks. So I drove down from, you know, graduate student. I drove down from New Jersey. Took me on a drive. He goes, I have an 18-acre parcel. I have a hauling company. I want you to put a composting site there. I'll lease you the site very cheap. I said, sounds great. And so with no money, no business plan, no backing, except for my little binder, I started this company, totally bootstrapped it, built it up into the largest composting company at its time in New Jersey. We did 35,000 tons of clean organic waste, non-sludge waste a year, produced topsoil for all kinds of buyers, got written up in the Wall Street Journal, replicated and did consulting work all around. And that's because I said, you know, the infrastructure on solid waste has got to change in New Jersey. Now think about the United States. Think about the world, because what starts here changes the world. You can quote me on that one. Next time you hear that, you say, I know the guy that came up with that. Transportation infrastructure. I have a student, John Zimmer. You can look it up. L-Y-F-T, Lyft. He took my Green Cities class. He was the first in his class in the hotel school. Did you have a good evening? That's what they teach them to say there. Is there anything we can get you? He was first in class hotel room. And what are you talking about hotels? You talk about occupancy. So he's taking Green Cities, and I gave him a lecture on transportation, that sequence I just told you, you know, paths to roads, roads to canals, canals to railroads, railroads to planes, what's next? And he said, huh, automobiles. Most automobiles have one occupant. That means there's an occupancy ratio of 1 to 4 in that vehicle. What if we could fill the rest of those seats? And he started Zimride, which he sold to Enterprise, and then he just started Lyft, which is now in 7 cities in the United States. They just got $75 million investment into their company. He is inventing a new type of transportation because something he got out of my class, but then he ran with and translated that into real action. So that I did it in solid waste in one little instance. He's doing it in transportation now in several cities. Energy, transportation in all the other cities, solid waste in all the other cities, food production, housing. Anything you can lay your teeth into that you love and is your passion, you can either have a storied career in grassroots advocacy, which is an honorable thing to do. You might end up being president of the United States someday if you get into community organizing. Or you might make some money. You might make more money than just making a living because the infrastructure has to shift in the country. It has to. And somebody's going to do it. And as my dad once said, most people didn't know they needed to buy something until an American showed up and said, you need to own this. It's in our DNA as Americans. We love to build things and sell things and change things. Welcome to Nirvana, Mr. and Mrs. America. You know, this is kind of nice, but I'd like to change the color of the curtains, right? We're always into changing stuff. We're very good at it. That whole infrastructure's got to shift. That's where the tide's going to be, and it's going to be across the board. Next question. Are you having fun?
Actually.
It's time to go home now.
Yeah, it is, but it was we could be here all day, but we can't be here all day, unfortunately. Thank you all for coming out. Fill out the half sheet. It's either in your chair, or if you don't have one, they're on the little wooden dividers here at the center aisles. There's pencils there, too. We do want to know what you thought of the program and what you think that we should do for future programs, and thanks very much to Dr. Robert Young.